Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we feature an interview from the Book Smart Tulsa Studio Tulsa Live event this past weekend with Krista Tippett, the host of Public Radio's On Being, and the author of the new book, Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. From her years of conversation with theologians, scientists, poets, and activists, and artists of all stripes, Tippett has asked about what it means to be human, how are we spiritually evolving, and what really matters in life. The book has been called a masterclass on living, with the life lessons coming from people ranging from physicist Brian Greene and civil rights veteran John Lewis to poet Elizabeth Alexander or playwright Eve Ensler. Krista Tippett is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster, the host of On Being, heard Sundays at noon here on Public Radio 89.5, and a New York Times best-selling author. She received the National Humanities Medal from President Barack Obama in 2014 for her, quote, thoughtful delving into the mysteries of human existence, unquote. We spoke this past Saturday at All Souls Unitarian Church. So, Krista, thanks for being here, and congratulations on the new book, Becoming Wise. That's a very daunting topic, I would
yes,
have to say. One way of becoming wise that you write about is through the art of conversation. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I know from my own personal sense, and I'm not getting into beliefs or introspection about belief. I am more often about passion, the outer passion of people. But I've learned so much, and I have become a wiser person, thankfully, through the art of conversation. How can you become wise through that art of conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I could say so many things. A conversation is different from an interview, although an interview can be a conversation.
An interview can also lead to that sort of insight that
yes,
we're talking
it
about.
Yes, it can. I think a lot about listening, you know, because listening is a key component to a real conversation. And I think also that's what distinguishes a good interview from a so-so interview, or an interview that's just a Q&A to a conversational exchange, is that real listening takes place. And I think of listening as a basic social art, kind of a basic social technology, but it's something we have to relearn in this culture. Let me say this. We, for a few generations, have been really well trained to be advocates, right? To stand up for what we believe, to represent what we believe, to fight for what we know, and there's absolutely an important place for that. But we have lost some of these other arts of really being present to another person and being just on a very basic human level, being open to being surprised. I mean, that's something that gets lost when we're all in the room to represent something. And as I say, we need our representation, but we need both of those things to kind of, to be, I think, who we want to be to each other, to create new realities, to create the world together that we want to inhabit, that we want our children to be in. Listening, I think I grew up practicing listening as being quiet while the other person says what they have to say so that I can say what I have to say. And I think that that's what we see modeled a lot. And listening is not, I would say, most importantly about being quiet. It is most importantly about being present. And if you are truly present, if you really are curious, and again, the most simple expression of that is willing to be surprised, because again, we go into a lot of our conversational spaces knowing exactly who we're up against. I know exactly who you are, who you voted for, what you represent. Now, the other thing I'll say is that a conversation in which real listening is present, that the tone for that is set, and I would say the possibilities for that are either created or limited before any words are passed between you. You have to actually put some care into the space in which a different kind of conversation is possible. And that has to do with the invitation that is made. And again, it has to do with how you walk into the room, you know, the presence you bring into the room. You know, sometimes people say to me, oh, I can't believe the intimate space that's created pretty quickly with people in those interviews I do. And it's true, and I also do think it has something to do with the intimacy of radio. There's just something about, you know, radio creates an intimate space. I don't think it's rocket science to do that. It's a little bit countercultural because we tend to set up and kind of instinctively set up conversational spaces that's going to be a for or against, right? Something is going to be argued. It's going to be about competing certainties. But it is actually not that hard to create a space. So Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker author and educator, early when I was creating this show, he says we are very skilled in this culture at bringing our intellect, like many sides of ourselves, we know how to bring into our public spaces. We know how to bring our intellect into the room. We know how to wield opinions. And we've also become very skilled at bringing our emotions into our public spaces. But Parker says that the soul is another part of us still. And for the insights of the soul to speak its truth, it needs quiet, inviting, and trustworthy spaces. So I think we set out to create on Being a quiet, inviting, and trustworthy media space, conversational space. And I think that's actually a wonderful kind of quick prescription for what we need to be thinking about creating if we want to create new conversations.
New conversations in our social life, yeah. in our public discourse, too.
Yeah.
If I can follow up, being open to surprise, as you say, mm-hmm. that requires sort of a lowering of your guard that most of us don't feel all that comfortable doing.
No, and again, in the culture we've created, it's not always a smart thing to do. In many of our public spaces, it would not be reasonable to expect that of people, and it probably might not be good for them.
One of the things you wrote in the book was, in creating that space, you say, I usually throw out this very opening question of, how did you find your place in your faith and in your spirituality? It says, I almost always cut that from the show. Why
for
do
a
you
long
cut that?
Time. Yeah. Well, I don't anymore. But yeah, uh-huh. So my opening question, whoever I'm talking to, great theologian, atheist, physicist, I always ask about the spiritual background of someone's childhood. And I find that to be a magical question, and you can tailor that question, you can focus it in different ways, but I find that when that inquiry about the spiritual background of our childhood, and it may be about religious upbringing, it may be more than that, it may be other than that, but I think that what people end up tapping into is the questions, kind of the animating, big, deep questions they started asking early in their life. Questions that I find often, you see a very zigzaggy trajectory, but often this is what people have kind of followed, pursued for the rest of their life. What I love about that question too is that is a soft searching place in us, and it's not that soft searching place in us is not the guarded way we tend to walk into discussion.
Right.
In public.
With a microphone, too. Yeah,
yeah. So it kind of settles people in a place in themselves that actually what I found is that shapes everything that follows. Like it starts in a different place and it makes something different possible. But you're right. I wrote about how I've always asked that question to start, but for years and years and years, really until I think just the last couple of years, and I think it may be my new younger producers who've said, this belongs in the show. Mm-hmm. Because in the early days, I was worried that didn't sound like a public radio question, right? And I thought, oh, and people are going to be listening, and that's going to be the first thing they hear, and may just have come out of the news bubble. And now it just seems crazy to me because it's elemental.
But that gets back to that whole art of conversation and interview, but art of conversation and interview, which is it doesn't have to be for or against. It doesn't have to be binary.
No.
And what do you learn by getting out of that binary ideal pretty quick?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is in our show we do a big long conversation generally with one person, and that's pretty rare even on public radio these days. And I think early on we kind of have this idea in this culture that you have to have two sides, you know, for it to be well-rounded. But my experience, if you interview a wise, intelligent person who's lived a life, and that person is willing to be honest and revealing and go deep, there are so many more than two sides in that life, right? There you have true nuance. You have somebody who, even if they represent some deep certainties and big truths, and they will also share their questions, you get so much more nuance from that one voice than you get certainly from two sides. I mean, two sides is to impoverish every single subject we have to discuss.
We're all full of contradictions.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
If we can go back to the book for a moment, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. That's a bold topic.
Yes, it is. So the word becoming is just as important as the word wise. It's not a destination, and I have not reached it.
So why did you decide to write this book?
Interestingly, I didn't call it Becoming Wise. I named it after it was mostly written. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that that's actually what it was called all along, because that's what it was about. But the original impetus for the book was this question that people have asked me across the years. You know, they've said, you've interviewed so many wise people. What are the recurring qualities in these graceful lives? And so that was the question, that was the inquiry I was pursuing. And it was a very tortured process. It took about 7 years, and I had a lot of, you know, the classic writers say, I don't know, was Anne Lamott, 100 mm-hmm. shitty drafts. I had so many bad drafts, and I don't know, eventually it got simpler and simpler and simpler in a way. I thought I was going to have like 10 or 11 chapters on these recurring themes, and they had flowery poetic titles, and as I dug more into it, I realized what's so important about this is not that we put wisdom up on a pedestal, but that it is something accessible to all of us, and that it emerges through the ordinary elements of our lives, through the raw materials of the lives we've been given.
You said you had 10 or 11 areas. What did make the cut? Because I'll tell you, we talked a little bit about words, but words, body, love, faith, and hope mm-hmm. made the cut. So
yeah.
What went by the wayside?
I thought I would probably have a chapter on mystery, mm-hmm. but I realized that mystery is just woven all the way through. And also that mystery is not something off by itself, but is also a common human experience, like being born and falling in love and dying.
I think it goes hand in hand with faith myself.
And it goes hand in hand with faith.
I mean,
and
faith
it goes,
and doubt or faith in
it
mystery.
It goes hand in hand with just inhabiting our bodies. It is a companion, a necessary companion to hope. So yeah, it's in all of them. I guess another subject that fascinates me is time, both a spiritual view of time and a scientific view of time. Physicists are the ones who will tell you that time, the way our five senses break it down for us in terms of past, present, and future, just doesn't add up. And also, I would say our theological traditions, not to mention psychology, you know, more and more we are understanding past, present, and future in this dynamic, constant interplay. And I also think that great thinkers and great people with great lives take a long view of time, a generous view of time. They don't give in to the perception that I feel is so pervasive for us now that time is a bully. But a long view of time, which is very nourishing, it's very un-American too. I think it's more like it's a framing for the book as a whole. It's a way to be looking at reality, to be taking in mystery as well as what we know, that makes, you know, these elements of living, this emergence of wisdom that makes it more possible, that makes it more bearable when, as is inevitable, things feel imperfect and not the way we wanted them to be at all.
You describe human development in some of those terms. You describe human development today as being the adolescence of our species.
Yeah.
The 21st century globe is dramatically uneven, immensely powerful and creative in some senses, in some ways, reckless and destructive in others. I see where you have hope, because we all hope our adolescents get through that, get the combat boot in the head that all of a sudden they wake up. So that leads to hope. But I was interested about that turn of phrase.
Yeah, and actually it was a scientist who pointed out to me that if you look at the globe now, it resembles the kind of view we have of the teenage brain, which has all this incredible potential and this incredible energy and these flashes of brilliance and these flashes of insight And then, yeah, this terrifying capacity for recklessness and destruction. To insist that we are at the height of our powers, yeah, that would be a discouraging thought. We're not. And I think we kind of walk around thinking we are so advanced. Part of where that comes from in me, or a great inspiration for that thought, is from Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit paleontologist who's kind of a beacon for the book. He's there in the beginning and he's there again in the end. And he was, of course, you know, now we're in this great Jesuit moment. Jesuits are so cool now. And Teilhard de Chardin was a paleontologist at the beginning of the last century, when we were uncovering fossil remains of human evolution, like proving this Peking man was this fossil that he helped excavate. And he had this insight as he looked at these primitive physical remains of early humanity. And he believed that we are now spiritually at that place, so that people would look at us now and see us also as this, you know, this primitive, you know, this foundation on what we could become. And so he believed that evolution would proceed towards spirit. And to put that in very practical terms, I mean, he was incredibly prescient. He foresaw that humanity would overlay the biosphere with what he called the noosphere, from the Greek, from noos, or mind. The artifacts of our creativity and our knowledge and intelligence would wrap the globe, and we now live in a world where the internet wraps the globe. You know, he talked about a global brain, and we actually have something that's starting to look like that. But the question is, you know, I think that this notion of spiritual evolution, which he put out there as a possibility for us, is a wonderful frame to think about, you know, growing up spiritually. And I actually think there's so many things happening now that Teilhard de Chardin could not have foreseen. But the knowledge we're gaining about our bodies and our brains, and the, I don't know, spiritual technologies, I mean, even how we're learning to understand practices like contemplation and meditation, and ways we are actually learning to calm ourselves and to be more grown up. We have all these tools.
We don't always use them,
though. We don't always use them.
This is true, but that's some small irony that we have all these tools, but for a lot of folks, you know this too, that when you're talking about media, you should never look at media as any sort of truth. There's some truth there, but it's a distorted truth by its very nature, and that distorted truth is that we're all moving at 150 miles an hour. We don't have time for genuine interactions. We're looking at phones, and we're probably all guilty of that at one point or another, rather than looking at the person next to us. What I love about this book is that it does talk you through a lot of your guests and through your own insights, this idea of slowing down. It seems a very difficult thing in this early 21st century, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I perceive a real hunger and a readiness out there for us to be called to our best selves. And I think a lot of what comes at us in media gives us a mirror of our worst selves. This is what humanity looks like at its worst. And we get that 100 times a day. You know, we get the most terrible things that happen, the most terrible exemplars. You know, I think I was having this conversation with a journalist a couple of years ago who said, well, you know, the definition of news is, of course, we're not talking about public radio here. The definition of news is the extraordinary thing that happened today. But I would say that that's pretty much been interpreted and applied as the extraordinarily terrible things that happened today. And in a 21st century, 24/7 immersive news environment, we do not interpret, we don't internalize those terrible stories from today as extraordinary. We interpret them as the norm. Oh, right, you know, you're having a good day finally, and then, you know, you actually saw something beautiful, or you saw some kindness or some love, and then you listen to the news, you're like, oh, okay, that's who we are, that's the bottom line. That's who we are, that's what we're up against. It is part of the truth about us, but it is not the whole truth about us.
Well, and oftentimes when the only extraordinary good moment that's shown on the news is like a squirrel water skiing, too. You know?
true.
Be that as it may.
Yes.
This gets into something we touched on earlier as we were preparing, and it's something you said a lot of people have noticed about this book. You've written that change tends to happen in the margins and rather than the noisy center. And I think what you've been describing is that noisy center.
Mm-hmm. I have received this from so many of my conversation partners across the years who have a wide, big sense of history, who've lived through change happening, and it always, always starts in the margins. I mean, if you are bringing something truly new into the world, if you are creating a new reality, that fact that you're doing something that hasn't quite been done that way before means that it is not going to be noticed or probably accepted by very many people for a long time. That is the way it works. The noisy center is so riveting, but people who are actually creating redemptive new realities, this is an irony. This is how they fit in perfectly with media as it works, because you know where there's a modicum of humility, they are probably going to be the last people to also throw themselves in front of microphones or cameras to make sure that everybody, you know, they don't hire publicists, or they're not good at it when they do. A story that I've carried with me all these years is Joan Chittister, who's a Benedictine nun and just a brilliant woman and a historian. She said, you know, in 6th century Rome, the equivalent of the New York Times never carried a headline that said, Benedict writes rule. But that little movement that St. Benedict started with, I think at the end of his life there may have been 12 communities with 12 men. Nobody noticed this thing happening, and yet this, you know, of everything you could pull out from what was happening in that historical moment is what literally kept Western civilization alive 1,000 years later. And I find it very comforting that even with all of my resources as a journalist, I probably have no idea what it is that's fermenting right now, somewhere, in some margins, that will keep civilization alive 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now. And I think the lesson from that is that we get to take seriously the goodness and the change and the resilience that we are creating and seeing in the world that we can see and touch, and we just keep doing that for the sake of the world, and it matters.
One of the great things I took away from the book is this idea that there's a great sense of hope in the book. In fact, the last area that you describe is hope, but throughout the book there's these moments of, well, for one example, gathering a person in favor of reproductive rights, private rights, and someone who's anti-abortion, and getting them together, and you're not going to get them to agree, but you can at least, which is amazing to me, that you might be able to find some understanding, or in climate change and how that has changed. And you address both of these subjects in the book. We think of these as just absolutely, there will never be consensus or accommodation for a lot of the for and against in these areas. Do you think that's not necessarily the case?
It's not the case. We get riveted by these noisy abstractions or the noisy fights. All of these important subjects, they have a fight associated with them. And we hand over our discernment, our searching, you know, the fact that we have a lot of questions left about this, and we know other people do too, but we hand over our power by letting those fights essentially dominate and define our public encounter with these great questions of our time. And given kind of the tenor of the presidential election, you know, I don't think that the places we have for a long time looked to be the places that kind of model adulthood. I don't think that's functioning very well right now. I mean, I don't think that's just me noticing it either. But I do. So sometimes people say to me, you know, well, yes, of course we could discuss these things more fully, but you know, when do you think politics and media, and you know, they're talking about media, it's worse again, of course, not public radio. Do you think politics and media will get their act together? And the point is, this stuff is too urgent for us to wait for politics or media to get their act together. We can and must start having the conversations we want to be hearing. And it is possible to take on any of these subjects whether it's abortion or the environment or questions about our racial present, and set aside the way that subject always gets framed, where the conversation starts, we know exactly what the arguments will be on each side, we know exactly the dead end it will end up in. But just reframing the question is absolutely revolutionary. I mean, you know, there's more to it than that. There's all kinds of nuance you can add to that. But every important discussion does not have to be framed as an either or. And when you pull back the lens and you say, let's talk about what's at stake in human terms for all of us, when you just humanize that discussion, new possibilities appear.
I want to finish with another section of the book, and that's the section on love, which you refer to. We're here in a house of worship, All Souls Unitarian, and every house of worship, temple, synagogue, mosque, talks about love. You were talking about this enormous evolution in your own life of, you know, thinking of lack of love or love in your life. You said, I was using that word in a poverty of imagination and a carelessly narrow use of what you would say is an essential word.
Yeah. The chapter on love is really important to me. And one thing I'm proposing is that we could learn to hold the question of love, to let that be part of our framing, our belonging to each other. But I'm not talking about romantic love, which is usually what we talk about when we talk about love in public. So we have to open up our imaginations about the many kinds of love. And, you know, love as a practical, muscular, robust thing that may or may not have feelings attached. It's a way of being and doing. And I did have this point in my life after I was divorced, where I was present to my children in this beautiful way. I started having dinner parties again, you know, just cooking meals for people. I invested in my friendships in a new way. And yet, I would have these conversations with people and say, yeah, you know, everything's great in my life, but, you know, I need love in my life, right? And I don't know, someday, one day, and I don't know when this happened, I heard myself saying that, and I realized I was perceiving scarcity in the midst of abundance. And just by the way I was using that word, words are so powerful, and that's just a huge theme of this book. I have so much love in my life. I have so many different kinds of love. Other languages, like Greek, you know, uses different words for different forms of love. Like there's philia, the love of friendship. There's eros, which again we're talking about most of the time when we talk about it in public. There's agape, which is practical love. It's acts of love. In the Buddhist tongue, there's metta, you know, loving kindness, which is kind of a benevolent interest in others and a psychological acuity that you also have to have a benevolent compassion for yourself. And so just starting to name and honor the ecosystem of love, the multiplicity of that, the diversity, you know, the biodiversity of love as a practical thing and as a way to start imagining what love could look like in public.
Krista Tippett, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Krista Tippett is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and the host of Public Radio's On Being, heard Sundays at noon here on Public Radio 89.5, and a New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is titled Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and the Art of Living. It's published by Penguin Press. I spoke with her at a Saturday Book Smart Tulsa Studio Tulsa Live event at All Souls Unitarian Church. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Special recording help from Frank Crystal and the staff at All Souls Unitarian Church. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.